Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
Hey gang, I want to thank you for listening to this episode of How Did I Get Here? I know you have a lot of choices out there, and the fact that you're listening to this episode right now is not lost on me, so thank you. I'm not sure what platform you're listening on, but whatever platform you're on, give us a follow. And if you like what you hear, leave us a rating. It takes just a second, and it means the world to me. Plus, it really helps the show. So thank you in advance. And remember, the last 100 episodes of How Did I Get Here are available on all streaming services. Now, enjoy the show. Johnny, I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I hope you guys have all had a good week, whatever it is you did this week. Gang, I feel much better. I had COVID last week, and I started feeling better on Sunday, and I've been feeling better every single day, and I'm back to myself. Feel great again. So thank you for all of your kind words and messages that you guys sent me. Made me feel good, know that I was cared for. All the sweet people that offered to bring me food and medicine and stuff. Very, very nice. We have a very nice community here. It was a lot of musicians that were very nice. And you know, gang, when someone kind of has a problem here in our music community, the musicians and the community all band together to help those people. And the reason why I'm saying that is because tomorrow, Saturday, May 11th, and Sunday, May 12th, there's a couple of benefits going on in Austin for our dear friend, John D. Graham. John D. has been bravely walking around with a broken neck for a long time, but recent testing has finally identified the issues. He had surgery a few weeks ago and is improving quickly. However, he is a working musician who is currently out of work, and due to his recovery, John cannot earn any significant income for at least 3 to 4 months and possibly longer. Two benefit shows will be held on Saturday, May 11th at the Hole in the Wall, and Sunday, May 12th at Meanwhile Brewing here in Austin, Texas. Now, Sunday at the Hole in the Wall kicks off at 4 p.m. and goes all the way till probably midnight with a bunch of artists, at least like 16. You got Jenny Reynolds, Kathy McCarty, Jamie Lynn Wilson, Larry Seaman, Jennifer Cook, Alejandro Escovedo, Wild Seeds, Curtis and James McMurtry, Mike Nikolai, Bobby Rock, James Ingram, Betty Sue, Andrew Duplantis Band, and my dear friends closing out the night in a jam fashion, my friends Matt Giles, Walter Trager, Beaver Nelson, and my soul brother, Scrappy Judd Newcomb. So that's Saturday, May 11th at the Hole in the Wall. Now, Sunday, May 12th, which is Mother's Day, they'll be doing another benefit. Let's Help John D. Graham. Benefit with music from John's Pals, hosted by Jennifer Cook, at Meanwhile Brewing here in Austin. That's Sunday, May 12th. It kicks off at 7 p.m. Flavor Harmony, Choppy Waters, Shawnee Kilgore, Andrew Duplantis, Jennifer Cook, Pam Peltz, Matt Giles, and Deanne Renee all playing 15-minute sets. So let's help John D. Graham this weekend, all right? The community gets together. We help our dear old friend John. Speedy recovery, get through his recovery, and get him back on stage so he can start entertaining us again, because that's his damn job, right? Gang, I have a great show for you today. I'm so excited about this. I talked about it on last week's episode, the last episode that came out, because I am so excited about it, gang. Today, singer-songwriter, guitar player, co-founder of the band Wang Chung, Jack Hughes is my guest today. Now, Wang Chung is on their way to Austin. Yes, that's right. They'll be here next Friday, May 17th at the Rail House in Kyle, Texas, just outside of Austin, Texas, on the Abducted by the 80s tour. It'll be Wang Chung, The Motels, and Naked Eyes. They'll be playing Saturday, May 18th at the Wildcatter Saloon in Katy, Texas. And on Sunday, May 19th, they'll be at House of Blues in Dallas. They're going to be touring for, I think, a month or two here in the States doing this Abducted by the 80s. So go to WangChung.com to get tickets and find out when you can see Wang Chung. I was very, very excited to talk to Jack Hughes. What an amazingly cool dude he is, man. My first exposure to Wang Chung was when I first heard Dance Hall Days, and I loved it. I loved it. It was a song that didn't really sound like any other song on the radio at that time. It had a different groove, that sort of shuffle groove that was so cool that people were doing out in England. And it cracked through to the United States, and I got into the band. And then in 1984, my friend Mark Hallman, my friend Eliza Gilkison, and her then-husband, Revis Moore, all went to go see the Cars, and we had backstage passes and the whole thing. I was 15 years old. It was a Heartbeat City tour. We went to South Park Meadows to see this band, and the opening band was Wang Chung, and we saw them from the side of the stage. I saw them play Dance Hall Days, and then I have this funny memory that I don't think happened, but we were on the side of the stage, and they ran by after the show. And in my mind, I thought he gave me 5, but I don't think he did. I think that was the story I told at school the next day. Anyway, so my next experience with Wang Chung was the album To Live and Die in L.A. I remember seeing the movie, the William Friedkin movie, fantastic movie that they did. Not only, they didn't just do songs for it, but they also did the score for it. They scored the movie. And somebody made me a cassette that had like ABC, How to Be a Millionaire. Remember that album? And Wang Chung, To Live and Die in L.A. on the other side. And I loved it. And I was listening to Live and Die in L.A. last weekend. And I was like, wait a minute, I had this. How did I have this? And that whole thing came back to me, the cassette, the whole thing. And then, of course, gang, you realize in 1986, they put out a song called Everybody Have Fun Tonight. And that exploded. And still goes on to this day. It's in the zeitgeist. People say Everybody Have Fun Tonight. People say Everybody Wang Chung Tonight. Some people that might not even know what Wang Chung is because they're so young, they miss the whole Wang Chung situation. They just say it out of habit because when you cross through in pop culture on that level and you spread, you know, everybody knows Wang Chung. Everybody knows that song. People remember that video. Anyway, Wang Chung has gone on to put out more records, fantastic records. I actually was listening to their album, The Warmer Side of Cool, that came out in 1989. Fantastic record. They've gone on to do stuff. They've split up. They've gotten back together. But Jack Hughes has also had a pretty prolific solo career, a very prolific solo career. You can find his music, his latest single called Since 2017, gorgeous, gorgeous song, and his album Primitive, and Electro Acoustic Works 2020, which came out in 2021. I'll put links to Jack Hughes and to the Jack Hughes and the Quartet, which is a fantastic jazz band. It's this dude's influenced by prog, by jazz, by all this stuff. All of this music, the solo stuff, the Jack Hughes and the Quartet sounds completely different than Wang Chung. But anyway, he and his partner in Wang Chung, Nick Feldman, have been working on a new sort of greatest hits, B-sides, demos, and unreleased tracks collection, which will be coming out, I think, later on this year, called Clear Light and Dark Matter. We talk all about it. It'll be on CD and vinyl. They also, their latest Wang Chung offering is Orchisography, which is Wang Chung playing their songs with an orchestra, which is fucking so cool, man. It is really, really gorgeous. They also have an instrumentals version, which is great for like when you're just cleaning the house or doing stuff. Sometimes you need a little discreet music. You don't want anyone telling you anything. These are gorgeous renditions of Wang Chung songs. Get out there and check out Jack Hughes and the Quartet. Get out there and check out his solo music. And get out there and check out Wang Chung. Gang, I want to thank my friend Lourdes for setting this up. I really, really had a great time talking to Jack. He's a lovely, lovely person. We had a lot of laughs. And I just love the band, too. Like, going back and digging into their music. Like, I talked to him about their guitar sound. I talked to them about his experience. And did he have a good time being really famous in the 80s? You know, that's a good question. Because fame sometimes is supposed to do something to you that it can't really do, which is fix you. So it depends on whether you're broken or not. But Jack and I have a really fascinating conversation about his journey in music, about the Wang Chung story, about what they're up to now. And don't forget, gang, Abducted by the 80s. This tour will be starting off in Austin next Friday, May 17th at the Rail House in Kyle, Texas. Saturday, May 18th at the Wildcatter Saloon in Katy, Texas. Sunday, May 19th, House of Blues, Dallas, Texas. Go to WangChung.com for all of your Wang Chung needs. And please enjoy my conversation with Jack Hughes from Wang Chung. Let's get down. Sir,
I'm good. Yeah, how are you doing?
I'm doing really good, man. I've been really looking forward to having this talk with you. I actually, sure. I watched this this performance. Did you perform last week on that television show in Rome? That Italian television
yeah.
show. That
you
was
did,
great,
yeah.
man.
Yeah, I mean it's fun to do. They're kind of quite old school in the way they approach it, you know, and so they have makeup and they have, although it was just a lady with a brush, you know, but it's, these days, you're usually doing these sort of things, everything's on a shoestring these days, and Italy, they still seem to have, you know, spend a bit of money on the production and everything. So.
Yeah, it seemed like full scale.
Yeah, it was. yeah, there was, you know, live band and everything, you know.
Yeah. Really quick, let's talk about this Abducted by the 80s tour. And
sure.
I just want to make sure that when you're here in Austin on Friday, May 17th at the Rail House in Kyle, Texas, which is just outside of Austin, it's you, the Motels, and Naked Eyes?
That's correct.
Okay. Man, what a great lineup.
Yeah.
How did
it's good, I think.
Did you guys, like, do you guys share a booking agent, or how does a tour like this come about?
I don't think so, actually. No, certainly not Naked Eyes. No, I think we just sort of reached out to a bunch of bands. Obviously, people get booked up, you know, way in advance
sure.
and so on. You know, it's a question of sort of finding people who you feel sympathetic with, you know, that you think are going to make a show that makes sense, and also people who are nice, I guess, you know.
yeah.
Also a sort of exciting show as well, you know. So I'm a big fan of the Motels, and Martha in particular is just great.
Me too.
And Good Eyes, we've done a lot of work with them before, you know, and they're great, actually, especially in the band version. They do a great show.
Oh, that's fantastic. So you guys, it's you and Nick, as usual, right?
Yeah.
And go ahead.
Ask you a question. I was going to say, Josh Thompson on drums, who's been playing with us for over 10 years now, and Dave Schultz on keyboards, who plays keyboards with Berlin on occasions. But these days, does a lot of work with us, and Dave's been with us the last 4 years or so, I think.
Yeah. That's fantastic. So how long of a set, since it's just three bands, do you get to do kind of a full set? Do you get to do?
Yeah, 45 minutes is what we're aiming at. So I guess that's sort of, what should we say, you know, half of what we can do, you know. But that's comfortable, 45 minutes on a sort of ongoing basis, you know, because I think with touring, you know, the gigs themselves are okay, you know, but being the singer, you have to sort of look after your voice to a certain extent, but it's all the traveling in between, you know, so 45 minutes is about right. And I guess having longer sets was born out of the experiences of working with various tours, sort of 80s package tours, if you like, where you have a lot of bands and you can really only play maybe three or four songs, which is sort of frustrating to the audience. I don't mind it, but I prefer a longer set, you know.
Right. And those, it is interesting because those shows, I actually saw one like a long time ago. I saw, remember Club MTV?
Yeah.
Oh, I remember you know what it was? I didn't see their performance, but it was in Houston, but it was the Club MTV tour when Milli Vanilli's CD started skipping. It was like a couple of days before the actual show because I had become friends with, remember that band Real Life? They had that song,
yeah.
Send Me an Angel. I'd met them at an in-store and then they invited me to that show that night and then came to see my band after that. But I remember thinking how shitty it must be to travel around and only jump out and play two fucking songs a night. That would drive me nuts.
Yeah, it does get you down a bit. But, you know, Things are what they are. You know, we've done the Lost 80s tour for quite a while now. I dipped out of touring for a while, but Nick continued on with it, you know. And we're going to do some Lost 80s shows this year as well. You know, the thing with that is that it attracts a big audience, you know, and they play some nice theatres and so on, you know. So, and also you get an audience that isn't sort of necessarily just buying the ticket for Wang Chung, they're buying it for all sorts of other stuff, you know. So you get to meet new people, and to that extent it's a great thing to do, you know. But I think now that we've done quite a lot of that, we're hoping that there's enough residual Wang Chung fans, you know, to make up a show like that we're doing in Texas, in Austin.
Yeah. I've played that place. I like that place.
Cool. I've never been there, but I'm looking forward. What's your, Johnny? You're in a band?
I'm in a few bands, but I'm in an actual 70s and 80s super hits cover band.
Oh, okay.
We tried doing always something there to remind me of that Naked Eyes song at an all 80s show that we did last year, and something was very terrible about it. We were told by our sound person to never play that song again live. But normally we're really good, Jack.
Yeah,
that's the truth.
Yeah, that's a Burt Bacharach song, right? I think
yes, it is. So that's true. That's right.
Some tricky chord changes in it, no doubt.
I do want to let you know I saw you in 1984, in the summer of 1984, here in Austin, Texas, at South Park Meadows, with my mentor Mark Hallman and the incredible songwriter Eliza Gilkison. I don't know if she's been a Grammy nominated singer songwriter. And I was 15 years old, and we went to go see the Cars. Great. And we stood on side stage, and you walked by me. We caught your set, and you walked right by me. And in my mind, you gave me a five, but you probably didn't. So it was just like my 15-year-old self. That's probably what I said at school the next day. Oh, and the guy from Wang Chung gave me five. I remember how great you guys were, and how fantastic you sounded even on the side of the stage. And and then I remembered this weekend when I was listening to the whole To Live and Die in L.A. album, I actually had that, and forgive me, but somebody taped it for me. So on one side I had ABC, How to Be a Millionaire, on the other side, Wang Chung, To Live and Die in L.A. What a great record that is. I mean, that is a fucking great record even now. And like the drum programming on it is insane.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, man.
You know, that we sort of produced ourselves.
You did?
You know, all the other Wang Chung stuff, you know, even the first Wang Chung album that we did in the UK, where we spelt the name differently, was produced by Rhett Davies, who did all the rocky music stuff. And then Points on the Curb was Chris Hughes, and Mosaic with Everybody Have Fun Tonight, Peter Wolf, yeah.
Chris Hughes was the Tears for Fears,
Exactly.
Awesome.
Yeah, so Chris is a friend of mine still, actually. In fact, we are grandfathers to the same child.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Awesome.
His daughter was with my son, and so they have a child together.
That's amazing. Congratulations.
It is amazing. Yes.
Yeah.
Chris and
so you have two babies. Together.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So let's go back to Live and Die in LA a little bit, because that record really is it's amazing. And I love the journey that the way that I listened to it wasn't on sides, because it was like on a 90-minute cassette, so I listened to it like you would on a CD. So it went from like vocal music to kind of spooky instrumental music from the William Friedkin movie that was so amazing.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, the model for that was David Bowie's albums, Low and Heroes.
Oh, yeah.
Which also had songs on one side and then his spooky instrumental stuff that he did with Brian Eno on the other side, you know. And I love that format, you know. And at the time, Geffen Records, who were at our label, were not super keen on doing a soundtrack album, because in those days, a soundtrack album was like a whole different thing from a top 40 album, if you like. Right. You know, it was almost like a whole different team of people worked it. And I think they were a bit sort of nonplussed about what to do with it, you know. So at the time, it didn't do particularly well as an album, and there was certainly a huge amount of pressure on us afterwards to come up with a top 40 hit, which became Everybody Has Fun Tonight.
You did that. But over
the, you didn't get it right there. Over the years, I meet so many people who have sort of got into To Live and Die in L.A., through their own interest in music, if you know what I mean. So it's not an album that would have been rammed down your throat with advertising or stuff. It's something that you kind of come across. And I think in that way, it's quite a special album for people, you know.
Yeah. And there aren't many bands that, I mean, I was trying to think about that. There was that weird Toto Dune movie where Toto did the score and the soundtrack. But were you like in the studio with the film being played on a thing and you're no,
we didn't do that. We basically got a call from Bill Friedkin himself, the director, you know, which is unusual in the movie business because usually you're dealing with music supervisors or you know, further down the food chain, you know. But with Billy, you're dealing with him director, and he basically had been using one of our songs from the previous album, Points on the Curve. Song called Wait, and he was using that as a basically he would watch the day's rushes, as they call them, you know, and just to have that song playing in the background to give him the sort of atmosphere, you know. And he said, I've just become sort of obsessed with that song. That's the song that I want to use it in the movie, but I need more music like that, you know. So can you do that? And I just said yes, you know, because you don't say, oh, let me have a think about it, you know. We just did that, but in those days, obviously, there was no internet, you know, to just like push, you know, send us a clip of a movie. So he put some stuff in FedEx, but we were literally in the studio the following week recording this stuff. You know, it was all done very, very quickly. Geffen insisted that we just have 1 week to record it because we were supposed to be writing hit songs for our next album, you know. But in that sense, it was such a breath of fresh air, you know, because I guess record labels, anybody who's in the business end of the music, you know, looks at the artist, you know, I've written Dance All Days, and they think, well, just write Dance All Days again. What's the problem? You've done it once. So, but for an artist, of course, nothing could be more further from the possibility. You know, it's like, it's, for me at least, you know, I've never been able to sort of replicate it or go to that place again, you know. And that's not for want of trying in some ways, you know. So, getting this call to do this music that was essentially instrumental music, you know, to make it long form because we needed to create an hour of music, really, you know. So we just sort of, you know, programmed this whole kind of long 12-minute thing and then found some scraps of stuff that I'd written before with some piano and cello stuff and, you know, just fleshed it out with a couple of songs as well.
Well, there's that's interesting that you say that because there is another side to Jack Hughes that isn't just the Wang Chung pop songs that you've known to love for the last 40 years. Jack Hughes and the Quartet, like there's like a 20-minute piece on there. That's really fun. I mean, that is like, did you? I don't even I can't even get the words out. That is a whole different side of you that one does not expect to hear.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. There's certainly not a side that's ever been found space in Wang Chung particularly, you know, although I guess To Live and Die in LA is the clearest space for it. And maybe tracks like The World in Which We Live on Mosaic, you know, with these sort of slightly ambitious in terms of the musical structure anyway.
Right.
Songs, you know. I mean, I grew up, well, as a kid, I grew up listening to the Beatles. But they, again, are a massive lesson in sort of expanding the whole realm of what pop music is, you know. But then I got into prog bands like Yes and Genesis, and Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin. I'd call Zeppelin a prog band as well, you know, in the sense they're using extended structures. And, you know, the goal isn't a repetitive chorus, but a kind of, I don't know, it's more of a sort of musical cohesive goal that they're after, you know.
Yeah. It seems like, and I've been kind of learning this from another podcast. Have you ever heard the Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp from Spandau Ballet,
no,
Guy Pratt, the bass player?
I know Gary from working with the Saucer Full of Secrets project.
So those guys, really, there's a thing from if you grew up in Britain, way more than here, those bands like Yes and Genesis really hit a generation of musicians really hard. Like, I didn't realize that Gary Kemp from Spandau Ballet was this massive prog head. And not until it was actually your solo album. There's this great songwriter composer thing that also throws in these prog jams every once in a while.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now that was a real sort of release for me doing that album in many ways. It was a sort of emotional release. So this was an album called Primitive that I made at home in 2019. I wrote it. I wrote most of the songs in a sort of 3-month period, actually. I know a lot of people sort of thought, oh yeah, these are songs you've had lying around for years. But actually it was a very concentrated kind of creative period. And I think one of the first times that I just took on the engineering it myself and sort of playing everything. I subsequently got a drummer to play on it as well, and some other musicians. There's an accordion player on one track and a double bass player, a musician I really love. So it was that was a labor of love, and one in which I didn't restrict myself to the kind of conventional notions of you've got to have a hit and you've got to have a this and a that. I just wrote from the heart, and you know, just wrote all this stuff. You know,
do you get to perform that stuff out much?
I have done it, yeah. Really just locally here in Canterbury, which is where I live. You know, I think we did a gig down in Brighton as well. We did sort of 2 or 3 gigs just to sort of do a little bit of promotion on Primitive. But you know, the nature of that band is it's quite a big band. With another guitar player, bass player, a couple of singers and stuff, you know, in order to do the songs justice, you know. And it's not something that you wanted to have as a sort of track, that type thing, you know. So we were playing it all for real, you know.
Yeah.
But it's something I'd love to do more of.
Yeah, it's really, you're a really prolific and really, you're a surprising creator. Just the avenues that you take in your different projects are wonderfully surprising, not like surprising in a sad way, but like really nice surprises. Your guitar sounds from back then, like the dance hall days, that compressed guitar sound that I equate with guys like you and Jamie Westorum from The Fix. How do you get that now? Because that's what, like, a Dynacomp and, like, right? Did you use, like, a MXR Dynacomp 90 or something?
Yeah, I do have one. I do have one. I tend to keep it minimal on stage with the pedals I'm using these days. Yeah. So I've got this thing called, I think it's called a warbler or something. I can't remember. I bought it off of Josh, the drummer, actually. He sort of said, I got this compressor, I never use it. That's pretty good. But, basically, I just use a Boss, you know, the standard chorus thing, you know, and I like to use a Mizubugi Lone Star as my main amp, because that has a bit of crunch in it, you know. But back in the day, obviously, it was a Roland JC120 and that MXR compressor, you know, and the chorus effect was in the amp, you know, a proper stereo chorus, you know, which was always hard to mic up live, actually, to get it to work, you know.
Yeah. Dude, I saw The Cult like 15 years ago. And Billy Duffy was using 2 JC120s.
Yeah, I can imagine that. Yeah.
Yeah. So is your sound a little tougher and tubier live?
Yeah. I think when people hear us now, they sort of think, this is like a rock band rather than a kind of pop band, you know. And, you know, we try and, you know, stretch out some of the songs a little bit as well. You know, To Live and Die in L.A. particularly, we, you know, sort of take the in section at a slower tempo than the rest of the song. And Dave takes a kind of a 70s Moog solo, you know. And there's other songs that we do. We do Fire in the Twilight, which is the song from The Breakfast Club. And kind of extend the section a bit, you know, with some guitar solos and stuff, you know. So it's a tougher sound, I think. And the band, you know, we did the 80s cruise earlier in the year, and we just had a day's rehearsal in this little backwoodsy place in Orlando. And you know, I kind of thought, God, this is going to be a long day, you know, things are all these songs, trying to remember them, you know. But within a couple of minutes, it was, I suddenly thinking, God, this band sounds really good, you know, because there's a cohesiveness between us because we've worked together for so long and we sort of know what we're doing, you know, and so immediately it creates that space where you have the freedom to sort of express and try things, you know.
Yeah. In my YouTube journey this weekend, I saw a little bit of footage from that.
Yeah.
You guys sounded great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing you guys play live. And the fact that you're playing 45 minutes and actually playing the whole set.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
You know what song I really like is Space Junk. I had never heard that before, you know, journeying into your music. That has these weird, like, Beatle scenes in it. Like very Beatley scenes, yeah.
Yeah, there's always that, you know.
Yeah.
I'm still obsessed with Beatles, you know, so and a massive, avid collector of all of these re-release box sets of, you know, like they've done the White Album, Sgt. Pepper, Revolver, Let It Be, Abbey Road, you know. So I find those sets really fascinating, all the demos and stuff, and hearing the evolution of the songs, you know, in recorded form, you know, really. But yeah, Space Junk was in 97, I think it was. Geffen said, we'd like to do a greatest hits album. Would you like to do a new song for it? And I think Nick at that time was working for Warner Brothers. Anyway, he knew this guy, Adam Wren, who was working with Les Field at the time. And Adam is a great engineer. And so we worked with him for a few days in the studio. And I sort of had this guitar riff and he came up with a kind of cool loop. And which is essentially what Space Junk is, you know.
Yeah.
And sort of very pleased with that. But then out of the blue, like 10 years later, we got a call, through our publishers, that Frank Darabont wanted to use it in this new series called The Walking Dead, which he was directing.
Oh, wow.
And there was a special case where they said, you know, he's a massive fan of the song, you know, that he's always conceived at the end of episode one, the first series would end with Space Junk and all kind of scene. So it's amazing, you know, and that's a really pretty obscure track. It was not a hit at the time, you know, Geffen didn't do anything with it particularly, you know. So suddenly this song is in this movie, well, sort of TV series, and is getting, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands of hits on Spotify, and, you know, it's like really blown up with a whole new bunch of fans, you know.
Oh, yeah. It's already got, like, over 8 million plays on Spotify. See it right now? This latest collection of new greatest hits and B-sides and demos and unreleased things, The Clear Light and Dark Matter.
That's something that's due for release. Hoping to have it for this tour, but, you know, the way the classically the music business, you know, doesn't get all that together until after the tour, you know. So,
right.
But there'll be ways of pre-ordering it and stuff, you know, and so it's not too much of a problem. But yeah, I think it's not going to be ready until probably September, that sort of time, you know.
Okay.
But the plan is to release, you know, the back catalogue has never been properly re-released and remastered and all that stuff, you know. And the idea is to re-release all the albums individually with related outtakes and songs that were never released at the time, and even some 12-inch mixes and stuff, you know. And that's the sort of project we've been working on for years, trying to get it together in the way that we want to do it. And but this initial release is a sort of, will be a double vinyl album. The first album will be the hits, properly remastered, you know, and everything you know and love about Wang Chung. And the second album will be a whole bunch of outtakes, B-sides, a couple of songs that were recorded at the time but never released. And interesting stuff, hopefully, that fans won't have heard before.
Yeah.
Except for some of the diehards who do get their hands on all this stuff. You know, but even they, I think, are going to be pleased with a couple of stuff, things that we've dug out. So
it's interesting because these new remasters, because like your records when they came out were like, you know, that was a time when all of this new equipment had come in, and all of these new digital ways of recording and these expansive things, and people had way more tracks than they ever had before. It's hard to, because things were, keep on getting mastered for a different, like when you go back and listen to those 80s, or not the 80s, but like the first round of Beatle albums that came out on CD, they sound like shit. Oh, God.
Terrible, yeah.
And then you have to keep on doing this, but there, it's like in modern times, the low end just keeps getting lower. Do you find that that's what the remasterings you're doing is, like beefing that up so that it doesn't sound small compared to other shit on playlists or on the radio?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of it for sure. You know, I mean, I think, you know, modern remastering, even to CD, can give you pretty good results, you know.
Yeah.
It brings a more sort of tube kind of presence to everything, you know. I mean, Points on the Curve, we recorded in Abbey Road Studio 2, where the Beatles did all their albums using the same desk that they recorded Abbey Road on. It's the same desk that Pink Floyd did Dark Side of the Moon and stuff, you know. It was like, so that was proper vintage gear, and we were recording to analog tape, you know. So there are really good analog masters. So it'd be great to be, you know, mastering from them, and especially remastering onto vinyl, because I, you know, I'm a big kind of vinyl freak myself, you know, and I have a great turntable and set up, you know. And for me, pop music and jazz, and I say pop music in the encompassing everything we're talking about, you know, and jazz as well, sound brilliant on vinyl. You know, classical music less so, because the dynamic range is so big, vinyl doesn't capture it quite as well, I don't think, you know. But then I think streaming is really good for classical music. These high-res streaming services are amazing for classical. So that's my current addiction. So buying vinyl on for pop records and jazz, and streaming Mahler Symphony.
Oh, that's nice. Real quick, what is your, do you like, on those, on the Beatle remixes, on the latest ones that have come out, are you a fan of the stereo or the mono mixes?
Yeah, interesting. Those ones, I do like the mono, especially Sgt. Pepper. I managed to source an old original copy of Sgt. Pepper that's in pretty good condition, and that sounds so tough, you know, much tougher than the remastered one that we have now, you know. And so, yeah, that's how I grew up with Sgt. Pepper, and certain effects like the bit in Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds where you got the guitar in one speaker and the voice in the other, you know. So the flame flowers of yellow and green. It sounds weird in stereo because you can just hear that guitar, you know, whereas in mono, it sounds like one sound, you know.
Yeah.
So, I'm a big fan of the mono mixes of that. But yeah, I like it all, you know, like Ringo said, you know, someone was talking to him about Love, you know, that show in Vegas, you know, and complaining about them mixing up the drums of Tomorrow Never Knows with the vocals from Taxman or something, you know. And he was like, well, you've got the old records if you want to listen to them, you know. So I kind of like that they're constantly trying new things out, you know. And even these new, you know, the new single that came out, you know, where they took John's vocal and, you know, sort of used this AI so-called technology to sort of split up the track into its constituent parts and then put it back together, you know.
So
I find all of that fascinating, you know. Yeah.
Do you find it scary in any way? Have you heard any of the stuff? Like, there's a new AI program that actually writes and records music. It does, like, it on its own. You can be like, give me a Wang Chung song, and it'll give me a Wang Chung song.
Yeah, I sort of think all that's bullshit, really. You know, it's not going to come up with anything kind of creative, I don't think. And that's a very silly thing to say, I know, because like 10 years down the line, maybe it will do exactly what you just said, you know. But right now, I think, you know, coming up with a Wang Chung song is, you know, you've got to be creative, sort of thing. You know, coming up with a, you know, Johnny Gaudi song, you've got to be, you've got a life experience almost, you know what I mean? It's like, so no AI is going to come up with that. It can sort of imitate, but it can't do the real thing. You know?
That's correct. But to the casual listener, it can be pretty freaky, like their belief in it and stuff.
Yeah. Now, I've listened to these things, you know, where they say, oh, here's Imagine with Paul McCartney singing it, and, you know, here's, you know, Penny Lane with John singing it, and it's like, it doesn't sound anything like Paul McCartney singing it, do you know what I mean? It's like, it's a bit like it. But it's like, you know, it's like, wake up, you know, maybe people are just going to sort of wake up in every walk of life, actually, because we're going to have to be a lot more vigilant about what's thrown at us, you know.
So. Definitely. Definitely.
Yeah.
How much time do you spend writing now? Have you always been kind of a disciplined writer, or do you do it when you have to, or when it comes, or what?
I have bursts of it, I think. I remember Don Henley saying he thought writers kind of worked on the well principle, you know, which is, you know, the well fills up with all your experience and anxiety and paranoia and stuff, you know, and then you write a whole bunch of songs out of that and the well goes down, and then you have to sort of go away from it and let it fill up again. So this last couple of months I've been working on an album that I sort of started the previous January, February, March kind of time. And I've got a third solo album pretty much certainly written and recorded at the basic level. And I would now want to get some people playing on it. And I would hope to get that out in sort of January, you know. So I find my writing is, it just seems for whatever reason more, there's more of it than ever sort of thing, you know. I think during the Wang Chung years, I found writing quite hard, probably because there was so much pressure to kind of come up with a hit all the time. It was just all that banging on about that. Whereas now it's sort of like there's a whole sort of vast array of areas of music that I can sort of work in. And the ideas come pretty naturally and pretty fast these days. So, and the opportunity to work at home with it and get these albums done, you know, I guess at some point I should really focus on promoting them more than I do, you know, but right now I kind of like enjoy it for what it is.
I can see how that would be a relief and, to have something where no one else has any say in it except you. That's how I feel about this podcast, is like, this is like one of the things that I have in my life where no one can tell me what to do with it. And so far I've been right. Sure. So
yeah. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, if you're at all creative, you know, being able to do your thing is what it's about, really, you know. And if you have success with it, then great, you know. But if not, it doesn't invalidate it, you know, because you're doing it for yourself, you know. I know, I think Rick Rubin has been saying that, hasn't he, in this book he's written about, you know, the Zen approach to surviving the music business, you know. And and he makes the point that a lot of artists, you know, it sounds insensitive to say we write for ourselves, but it's kind of true in the sense that if nobody's listening to it, it doesn't really matter. You still do it, you know. Obviously, when people do listen to it and they do feedback and they do take it to another place, that's totally amazing, you know. But the impetus that makes artists create their work, I think, comes from a sort of personal need, really.
Yeah. And it's difficult. Yeah. I don't think people understand, like, the... like the general public, I don't think understands how many stars need to align for a band to go from a band in a town to getting in our era a record deal.
Yep.
And then having out of that a fucking song that goes on the radio. Not even just one, but maybe two, three, four. And then I don't think they understand the amount of stars that need to align to it. And then just the level of pressure once you're in, like for you, your 80s experience was, I mean, you not only had hit songs, you had one song that, like if I told one of my little sisters that's in their late 20s now, hey, everybody, have fun tonight. They might turn to me and say, okay, everybody, Wang Chung tonight, without even knowing what they're saying. Like,
sure.
You have a song that was so, it's just a phrase in the zeitgeist that went on even outside, parallel to the song. You know what I mean? That's just, that's insane, man. That's huge. So did you have a good time? Like, were you having a good time, or was it a drag? Was it too pressureful? Or?
You know, it was a mixture. It was amazing, you know, and I think when Everybody Had Fun Tonight got to number two, we were number one on Cashbox, which was this other chart that was on at the time. And that was an amazing feeling. And all the stuff that happened to us was incredible, you know. And I subsequent to, you know, leaving Wang, well, not working with Nick for a while, you know, I sort of worked with some other bands producing and stuff like that. And I got, you know, some of them are really talented, you know, but for whatever reason, they don't have the right look, or they don't sound right, or it's just, as you say, the stars just don't align at that particular time. And, you know, they sort of go by the wayside, you know, so many talented people, you know. But, Yeah, so it's, yeah, I do sort of get how incredible having the sort of success that someone like me had, you know, because it's not like I'm so obsessive, you know, I got to be a star type person. You know, I guess I'm probably reasonably introverted, not introverted, but, you know, I'm quite happy with things being okay, if you know what I mean. They don't have to be off the scale. But the success that we've had has been just incredible, you know.
So you never had like a you were never jealous of Duran Duran or anything like that in your time, or have some kind of beef with Spandau Ballet or something?
Yeah, you think, I guess, yeah, a bit more success would be nice, you know, and a house in Tuscany or something would be nice. But, you know, it's kind of fine. You know, I'm not that interested in all of that stuff, you know. And I guess, you know, I have family. I have my three kids who now have their kids, you know, yeah. And I feel close to them and have a pretty good relationship. Well, a very good relationship with them. I'm very grateful for that because I know a lot of that sort of stuff becomes very difficult in this business, you know. And I guess I sort of see, you know, I get to really be a success in the music business, the movie business. You've got to give yourself to it, you know, and that can mean some pretty serious shit, you know. And I always manage to sort of stay just on the outside enough to retain myself, you know. But I got was successful enough to experience the rush of it and the miraculousness of it. And
right.
So yeah, I feel very grateful for the experience I had and I'm having.
Yeah, I mean it's interesting because you can tell the kind of people that came at this business with like a hole in their heart and their soul. Mm-hmm. That like if my dad doesn't love me, then everybody's gonna love me, and that'll fix it. And then it doesn't, you know what I mean? So you seem like you might have come from a more well-adjusted place, for starters.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I think that precise thing that you're talking about did drive me. Probably still drives me to an extent. You know.
Yeah.
You know, my dad was from a generation of men who never expressed their feelings. You know, when I started to sort of hug him, you know, during the 2000s, he just froze. You know, he couldn't deal with it at all. You know, so all of that stuff. You know, but you know, he's passed on now. You know, I don't know whether that makes a difference or whatever. But yeah, you know, what is it that drives people to stand in front of 80,000 people and playing the song they wrote in their bedroom and stuff like that? You know, it's not normal.
No, it's not.
It's kind of a thrill. It certainly doesn't fix the problem you thought you wanted to fix, perhaps. Didn't even know the problem that you had, you know. But it gives your life an incredible sort of lift. The experience is incredible. It really is. You know?
Yeah, I can only imagine. So how is it going out on tour? I was wondering this every time the bridge for Everybody Have Fun Tonight comes on. I'm always like, that poor fucking guy. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you got to do it now still all the time. That is
There's a technical solution for it. You know, so it's
a great bridge. Also, like that song, like going through it as a songwriter and listening to it quite a few times and then learning it. Mm-hmm. The pre-chorus, unbelievable. And the bridge, really, mm-hmm. like that weird key change is, it's awesome.
Yeah, it is really cool, that section.
But you do have to hit that every night.
Well, back in the day I did. I remember having to do that the first time we ever played it live, complete, you know, because obviously in the recording studio we did it in section.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Was on the Joan Rivers show. It was like, when she was at her, I think it was like 30 million people or something like that. And I was singing live and the band were miming. So that meant the band are all in the bar, just kind of like, hey, you know, they've got to do, look like they're doing vaguely the right thing, you know. And I was sweating it and just like thinking that because of that bridge, you know, it's like, God. But I did it. I nailed it, you know, so it's good.
Fantastic, man. Yeah. That is a great bridge, a great song. And you know, man, I listened to The Warmer Side of Cool a couple of times. That's a great record. Were there any hits off of that? Any radio songs off of that?
the first single was this track called Praying to a New God, which even then was kind of didn't go down well at radio stations. You know, it was too, don't talk about God, you know, especially not
New. Right.
You know, so yeah, I think the record company felt, I mean, the tide was definitely changing when we released that, you know, and I think Geffen had actually signed Nirvana and Guns N' Roses at that point. And the 80s were sort of over, you know. And also Nick and I, well, not so much Nick, because I think he sort of had a better vision and a sense of how the band could be sort of carry on, you know. But I was back in my sort of prog roots, you know. And I think things like The Warmer Side of Cool, the title track, and Big World, and some of those songs, even Snake Dance in a way. You know, they're not terribly kind of friendly songs, if you know what I mean. There's a lot of music in them and quite knotty. So the record company were kind of like, well, I don't know what we do with this, really, you know, because it didn't have a hit on it, you know, so not a conventional radio hit, at least. So we were hit that crossroads of, at that point, I couldn't face making another album, you know, so I just sort of split at that point.
What brought you back when you split?
Well, Nick and I sort of remained in contact, you know, because we get on really well, you know, we're brothers, and we've been through so much, you know, when you've been in a band and had that kind of success, you know, it's like being in a war, really. It's only you guys what happened and what it was really like, you know. And so when Nick was working for Sony and then later Warner Brothers, you know, he would call me up sometimes and say, I've got this band, I'd like you to come and listen to them, maybe do some tracks in the studio with them. So we were working together doing that, you know. We did Space Junk together in 97, you know. But it was, I think, around the mid-2000s when essentially we got some interest in our publishing and stuff, and that brought us back into doing this sort of business deal. And then from that, somebody contacted us about doing a sort of retro tour, you know, and which we did and enjoyed it, you know, and in fact realized that, yeah, it was probably more enjoyable touring now than it was back in the 80s, you know, when it was a lot more pressure and a lot more kind of I don't know, just playing those big places and I don't know, maybe we're just better musicians now, you know, like a lot of things when you do it all your life, you get better at it, you know?
Right. That's the weird juxtaposition of our careers, is that we're sprinkled with fairy dust when we don't know anything. But then when you get to be like Obi-Wan Kenobi level or Yoda level, nobody wants some fucking old guy, you know, up there playing, you know what I'm saying?
That's very true.
But you're actually very so true. Much better than you were when you started. Like, you've got, your powers are so great, you know?
Exactly right. Yeah. And your range of influences and you know, what you can draw on is so much better, you know? And I think, you know, all the sort of jazz stuff, I did a lot of that, you know, between about 2005 and 2012, you know, working with London jazz musicians and made a few albums that were like File Under Jazz, sort of, you know. And they really challenged my playing and, you know, and really made me think about sound and all of that stuff, you know. And you go through, again, being a musician, it's a sort of curious thing because it's such a sort of cruel mistress in a way in music. Do you know what I mean? It's always just out of reach somehow, you know, where you want to get to. And but on the other hand, it gives you the biggest highs as well, you know. So.
Of course. Yeah, man. Amazing highs. When you finish this tour and you go back, when you go and do your solo stuff, like whatever you do next. Mm. I'm sorry. What I was going to ask you, about the quartet. Do you play live with those guys? You tour, like play around with those guys as well?
Yeah. We do, you know, not as much as I'd like, sort of thing. And I'm not very good at doing, you know, more than one thing, you know, a typical bloke, sort of just on or off.
Did you come up with some kind of musical education, some kind of formal education that you were able to express yourself in a jazz way, you know, in a way like that?
I never took jazz lessons as such, you know. I just... I guess I met this guy who was he was actually giving my daughter Violet piano lessons. And when Violet went off to university, it was kind of like, okay, that's the end of that. And I said, well, come over and let's just jam and stuff. And he brought over some Thelonious Monk fake books, and we used to play through that stuff, you know. And then he had a friend who was a double bass player, and I remember doing a gig in the cellar of my house here, actually. It was an incredibly sort of impromptu kind of thing. But, yeah, it was very DIY, the complete opposite of what you saw us doing with the cars. Do you know what I mean? It was literally five people, you know, and not being very good either. But it was a great sort of a game, kind of like garage band experience. Do you know what I mean? Just like rehearsing for the hell of it, doing some gigs for friends, you know, and just kind of that whole thing. So that's how jazz was for me. It wasn't really like going back to college and learning stuff. Do you know what I mean? It was just a different mode of expression. In a realm where I was a sort of beginner, really, you know, and I felt comfortable being a beginner in that rather than intimidated, you know.
Yeah. So, now you have your own band. You play. It's a quintet with you. Is that what? If you're in it, then it's a quintet.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Exactly right. That's the sort of basic. Like sometimes we have a couple of extra horns or whatever, you know. So, and we've been working with two drummers, which I love actually. I'm a big fan of the Miles. Stuff from sort of like 1970 to 73, you know, those kind of albums like Dark Magus and I love his version of Crosby, Stills and Nash's Guinevere.
I've never heard that.
This long the jam. Yeah, it's a sort of like typical Miles. It's clearly he gave Wayne Shorter his part, Miles got his part. There's a guy playing this Indian droney tambura thing. I think Herbie and maybe two or three keyboard players, you know, it's a big band anyway, but everyone's jamming along just on the one chord, you know, and it's again a sort of 20-minute thing, but it's just amazing atmosphere, you know, and so stuff like that I really got into, you know, so I prefer that to the kind of Keith Jarrett, Pat Metheny type jazz, do you know what I mean, which frankly I find pretty unlistenable.
Is that sort of like that weird 70s fusion that I'm not that familiar with it, but whenever I hear that stuff, I'm always Pat Metheny. I had a drummer that would listen to Pat Metheny endlessly in the van, and I always wanted to kill him.
Yeah. No, I mean, I talk like this, you know, Pat Metheny's a phenomenal guitar player, but where the music lies, you know, I mean, I'm sure he could care less what I think. The jazz that I'm interested in is more from a more bluesy, soulful kind of place than what, you know.
Do you listen to new music coming out? Like, are you exposed to? Yeah. How do you find it?
Various ways. I mean, there's a radio station here that plays. It's supposed to be the classical station, but at night they have a sort of jazz program, and they also have a program where they play new music that's kind of, I don't know how you describe it really, but I've come across a couple of things fairly recently. And also just recommendations. I mean, I'm not in the throes, you know, the mainstream of new music sort of thing. But there's a guy called Casa Overall who did an album called Animals, which again is like it's in the jazz section of a record store that I go to, you know. But it's more of a sort of hip hop record in a way. But it's got some fabulous jazz piano playing on it, and it's very highly produced. It's a really creative album. And there's a band called Jockstrap, which sounds ridiculous. But it's two guys. There's a girl who plays harp and sings, and a sort of DJ type guy who messes around with the with the beats and stuff. You know, not messes around. It's slightly insulting. I'm sure he knows what he's doing. But I like their stuff. That's really creative. And a couple of years ago, there was an album called Promises by an act called Floating Points. I don't know if you ever came across that, but he's like a sort of English, kind of classically trained musician, actually, who did this album, and he worked with Pharoah Sanders. And I think it's the last recording that Pharoah Sanders made, you know. But that piece, I think, is just the most stunning bit of music, you know, in any genre, really. It's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. Well, man, I'll check those out. Jack, this has been really great talking to you. I really, I want to thank our mutual friend Lourdes for setting this up and hooking us up. It was a nice surprise. I also have to thank her for I dug back into your music as Wang Chung, yeah. And then I explored your solo stuff, and I'm definitely putting all of that stuff on my playlist, and people can get out there.
Cool.
I'll put links to all this stuff. People can go to wangchung.com for all of the Wang Chung needs. And Abducted by the 80s will be making its... You're starting the tour in Austin here.
We are.
At the Real House. Friday, May 17th at the Real House in Kyle, Texas. Saturday, May 18th, Wildcatter Saloon in Katy, Texas. And Sunday, the 19th at the House of Blues in Dallas. And they'll be playing through June around the United States. Yep. So keep an eye out for Abducted by the 80s. Go to wangchung.com for all of the dates and all of your Wang Chung needs. And I hope I get to meet you on Friday on the 17th.
I hope so too.
Yeah, man.
I'm sure we will. I'm sure we get to shake hands and hang out a bit. That'll be great.
Yeah, I really appreciate your time and I love talking to you, and hopefully we'll get to do this again.
Great, Johnny. I really appreciate it too. Thank you so much.
Nice meeting you.
Ciao.
Take care, Jeff. Gang, that was Jack Hughes from Wang Chung. What a fantastic conversation. You can see them next Friday, May 17th at the Rail House in Kyle, Texas. Saturday, May 18th at the Wildcatter Saloon in Katy, Texas. Sunday, May 19th, House of Blues in Dallas, Texas. That is the Abducted by the 80s tour. Wang Chung, The Motels, Naked Eyes. They'll also be heading out for the rest of the month until like through June, I think. So get out there and go to wangchung.com for all of your Wang Chung needs. Find out if they're coming to a town near you if you don't live in Austin, Houston, or Dallas. They're going to be playing everywhere, man. I want to thank Jack for doing the show. I really want to thank my friend Lourdes for setting that up. It was really special. It's fantastic getting to talk to that dude, huh? What a great combo. I will not forget that. All right? Gang, get out there. Check out Abducted by the 80s. Go to the John D. Graham benefits tomorrow, May 11th, Saturday, May 11th, at Hole in the Wall, Sunday, May 12th, 7 p.m. at Meanwhile Brewing. All right? I'll put links to that in the text of this podcast. All right, gang, thank you so much for listening. Thank you, Jack, for doing the show. Thank you, Lourdes, for setting it up. Get out to Abducted by the 80s, Friday, May 17th, the Rail House, Kyle, Texas, wangchung.com. Have a great weekend, whatever you're doing. Let's get down.